This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Today is the Friday recap where we revisit a few of the most interesting conversations we had this week. Up first, we'll get an update on Indiana schools and how they're handling the spread of COVID-19. There's been a lot of news around Indiana schools and how they're handling the spread of COVID-19 in their classrooms, from mandating masks to not reporting COVID cases. To give us an update on how schools are doing right now, we're joined by Eric Weddle, Managing Editor for the Education Desk at WFYI. Welcome, Eric. Well, let's talk about the latest news here when it comes to COVID in schools. What's the biggest news around quarantine guidelines in Indiana schools?
Right. So earlier this month, we had a change of guidelines from the state health department. And one of the big issues they wanted to really focus on was the quarantining of students. And basically what that means is, you know, right now, or until recently, a lot of students were being sent home for, you know, a week, 10 days, 2 weeks, if they found out that they were in close contact to maybe a student or a teacher at their school who tested positive for COVID. And so there was a lot of concern about that. So these guidelines are now allowing, it's kind of basically like it really reduced the amount of quarantining time almost down to zero that some students and staff now have to do with this new system.
And so what is the new system exactly with the guidelines on quarantining?
Yeah, so school districts now are basically, they can allow students who are asymptomatic. So now asymptomatic students and staff who are identified as being in close contact do not have to quarantine. And the state defines close contact as someone who's within 6 feet of another person who may have had COVID-19 for 15 minutes or so. But the school district has to require a face covering mandate. So you have to be wearing a mask all day in your school for this no quarantining policy to count.
Okay, so just to clarify, what I'm hearing here is that if you don't want to have a mask mandate in your school, you would have to
quarantine.
Okay.
Yeah. So basically, school districts that have not made a mandate and they're not requiring it all day, those school districts are going to have to quarantine their students. School districts that are requiring a mask to be worn throughout the entire day, they can decide to no longer quarantine students who have been in close contact with somebody with COVID.
That's interesting. There's just two different, I guess, paths schools can go down. Well, there's
been
some concern about schools potentially losing funding for having students do remote learning for too long. Can you talk about those concerns?
Yeah, so there's, you know, two different kinds of schools, not two different, but there's basically you have in-school, in-person schools, traditionally brick and mortar schools, we call them, and virtual schools, you know, and that's nothing really new. Indiana has, since the creation of virtual schools, Indiana has always funded them at a lesser amount of the per student funding. And right now, virtual schools who offer full-time virtual learning, they fund students at 15% less as students who attend brick and mortar schools. Last year, when the pandemic happened, everybody went virtual. You know, remote learning was what everyone was doing. Nothing in the law allowed those schools basically to be funded, the brick and mortar schools to be funded at 100%. So lawmakers heard the concerns. They realized it was a different year. It was a change nobody expected. So they changed the law. They allowed last year for full funding to be given to brick and mortar schools who had students being remotely. Well, that expired for this year. So there's been concern again that as we have students quarantining, the unknown future of this year, that you could have more and more students going remote learning. And if you spend more than half your time in remote, the state views you as a virtual student and would fund you at a lesser amount.
Well, that's interesting. I was wondering about that. You know, if the inevitable happens where people start going back online, if cases mm-hmm. continue to rise, that would create an issue. But I mean, is online learning a cheaper alternative overall, though? I mean, even if it's less funded?
Well, I mean, it would be, you know, if you think about, I mean, I don't know the intimate details, but if you have a school that's virtual all the time, they definitely have different infrastructure than an entire school district that is still running buildings, heating buildings, having staff. So that's where the concern has been, though lawmakers have though come forward so far and said that they are planning to do a change again this year to ensure that brick and mortar schools are going to get funded fully if they wound up doing remote learning.
If you have any questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. We're speaking with Eric Weddle, Managing Editor for the Education Desk at WFYI, about COVID-19 in classrooms and what's the latest in Indiana. Well, Eric, what are COVID numbers looking like at schools right now?
Right. Well, the past few weeks, you know, we've seen some record numbers, but the numbers just came out earlier today, about an hour ago, and we're seeing about 5,000 new positive cases in the schools. And that is less than we have seen, you know, the past few weeks. So there seems to be a little bit of a decrease right now. I mean, I think a lot of schools testing, you know, still seems to be an issue. I know there's a lot of talk about why there's not more testing at schools, and some schools are trying to figure that out. But we have seen, you know, a pretty consistent, you know, high number since schools, you know, started really coming into full swing in the past like 4 to 5 weeks.
Well, there's been some concerns at school districts across the country and here in Indiana about schools not reporting COVID cases or not keeping it up to date. Is that something that's mm-hmm. that's happening here?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you look at right now on the school distribution map that's available on the state website that shows where cases at. You know, today there are 627 schools that have not reported a case. And, you know, I know I've actually heard from some educators who have kind of been frustrated with people discussing that, kind of pointing it out, kind of saying, hey, we have a lot to do, you know, why should you expect us to keep doing all these additional things? But then you think of the other side where people just want to know, like, what is actually happening in our communities? So there doesn't really seem to be any kind of like accountability, and no one's in place to force these school districts to do it. I mean, even like on the local level, you have some school districts that publish this weekly. You can get it easily. Other school districts, it's not being discussed at all. So I think, you know, there is just, I think, a general concern, you know, as a journalist reporting on schools, you want to know what's going on. And it would be great if there is a way for schools to have an easier way, I think, to report this so everyone knows what's happening.
So do you think it's on the school's end that it's difficult to post this, or there's no sort of, I don't even know if it would be like some rule or law that mandates that they have to report cases, you know?
You know, I mean, I think, yeah, I mean, it needs to be, I mean, obviously, you know, a lot of cases are being reported to the state. The state has its own data. You know, my family we've experienced COVID. And when it was reported, you know, we had phone calls and there was tracing going on. So there's a lot of information out there that tracks who has COVID, where they're from. There obviously seems to be an issue with how easy it is for schools to do this. You know, I've even spoke, you know, to children on my own, staff my own school, that are just kind of overwhelmed in general, you know, like tracing the kids, figuring out who has been in contact and who's not. There just seems to be a lot more work that schools are faced with, you know, during this time. And it's just making them much harder to do it. Requiring it, making a rule, you know, I'm not sure how that would work for each district. I think everyone's under a different amount of stress and pressure right now.
Right. I mean, I'm imagining you're a teacher, but then all of a sudden you have to be a professional contact tracer at the same time. It's got to be a lot.
Yeah. And then, you know, we have the local health departments, you know, who some local health departments have tracked it. You know, there's been issues here in Marion County with the information being available publicly, because we had the local hospital that had a ransomware attack, and that even limited some of that information being made. So it's very complex. But I think there is frustration overall that, you know, it's September 2021. We've been into this for about a year and a half. Why isn't this easier to do?
Are we seeing any pushes for vaccines to be mandated for students or school staff?
I mean, mandate, you know, no, I have not seen that or not hearing about that, especially in public schools. I mean, right now there really can't be mandates made due to the status of the vaccines. You are starting to hear more school districts talk about providing incentives. Indianapolis Public School District has mentioned that they want to provide incentives for students. They have not come out with what that is, but they are now offering cash reward, bonus, or what have you, to staff now who can prove that they are vaccinated. So you're seeing different ways to do that. I've seen some school districts in filings with the state saying that they're going to use some of their federal COVID pandemic money to also offer bonuses to staff to do that. So I think right now, you know, schools are trying to do everything they can to keep students in class to keep people learning in person. And I think trying to convince more and more teachers and students to get vaccinated is one way that they're doing that.
Do you think Indiana's going to look to any other school districts? I think it's Los Angeles, the school board there voted that, that students 12 and above have to be vaccinated to go to school. Do you think that would ever have an effect here in Indiana?
You know, I mean, I really can't say, but I mean, last week, you know, when President Biden came out with, you know, his order for, you know, businesses, certain sizes of businesses to vaccinate their employees, to have them get vaccinated, you know, we saw the Attorney General of Indiana and, you know, the governor come out and say that they did not agree with that kind of an order coming down. So I don't really see that happening here in Indiana.
Do you think there's a chance we will see remote learning make a comeback, or are schools now sort of just in the place of like, we're just going to learn to live with COVID around us?
You know, I think it's still a wait and see. I mean, I talked to a lot of educators, you know, who they're planning, like, how do we do this now? You know, so many schools were really prepared last year to do remote. You know, they had everything in place. And some of that infrastructure exists. But I think people went into the school year with a totally different kind of mentality. They, you know, felt like it was going to be much more normal. And so I feel like now I'm hearing from teachers that, like, they're, you know, they're getting ready to go remote if they have to, because we just don't know what's going to change. And I think that's the uncertainty, I think, is what is causing a lot of unease with the teachers that I've spoke with and school leaders. You just don't know what's going to happen. But I think most people, everyone agrees that I talk to, you know, they want to find a way to keep kids in school as much as possible. You know, some school districts really aren't even offering those remote options that they did last year, just because it was so taxing on their staff.
What about students and parents, before we let you go here? Are they excited about staying in person or virtual?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm on a lot of different, you know, Facebook groups for families and students. And you know, there are a lot of families who are very concerned still, you know, about COVID, about how it can get into schools, about how through sports or extracurricular activities, you know, their students can get it or they can bring it home and transmit it to family members. So there is that concern. But, I think, you know, people want their kids in school learning face to face. And that proves, I think, to be, you know, the best way for students to learn.
That's Eric Weddle, managing editor for the Education Desk at WFYI. A reminder, this show is taped, but you can always reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. Just ahead, we'll hear the story of a Burmese refugee who made a new home in Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe, and it's the Friday recap where we revisit a few conversations we had over the last week. Coming up, we'll hear the story of a Burmese refugee who made a new home in Indiana. It's part of the conversations we've been having about refugees coming to the state, the support they need, and the assistance they're getting right now. With us now is Dali Tal, employment specialist for the Chin community of Indiana. Thank you so much for coming on the program.
Yeah, not a problem. Thank you for having me.
Well, Dali, I want to ask you, you know, how have news events like what's happening in Afghanistan impacted your own journey to the U.S.? Do you find that news very disturbing? I'm just assuming it's got to be stressful.
Yes, it is very stressful. And then right now it is very familiar to what is happening in Burma, too. And looking at the recent news, it is very sad.
So you're with the Chin community. Can you explain what the Chin community is for our listeners and people who don't know?
The Chin community is for everyone, but mostly right now it is mostly used by the Chin and Burmese people with the help that they need, such as reading letters, phone calls for their bills, and phone calls to USCIS for their permanent resident card or their citizen certificate. So it's basically just everything that you can think of, because since most of our people does not speak English.
Yeah, so you're providing services for folks, it sounds like. And is that some of what you do?
Yes, that is. Even though I am employment specialist, I still help them with reading letters and making phone calls for them.
Well, if you don't mind, I don't want to get too personal if you're uncomfortable, but what was your experience like coming to the U.S.?
My experience with coming to the U.S. is very nice. When I got here, I thought that I would see a lot of tall buildings, because when I was living in Malaysia, there was like a lot of tall buildings and a lot of I would say street market, but not here. I didn't see any of those, but it is very nice.
Yeah, I think the closest we have is like a farmer's market once in a while, right?
Yes, the one that we have, the one that Malaysia has, is like a whole street market. So it was like, it's a lot of fun too.
Right, right. And so you moved to Malaysia before you came to the U.S. What was that like to go there and then to come here? It seems like it's got to be a lot of moving around.
Yes, I get to experience a lot of things in Malaysia too. I get to learn a little bit about their culture, but I don't exactly know a lot of things. But they wear different clothes, and then they have different styles and everything. So I feel like coming here is a lot different, because I feel like American and Myanmar is a bit similar in when we wear clothing.
Interesting. Well, I don't want to, again, I don't want to have you say anything you don't feel comfortable with. Would you be able to share with us why your family left Burma?
My family left Burma because of the economy, and then because of the political reason too. My dad left for Malaysia first to find a better opportunities for employment, because there is no employment back home, and they had to do a lot of work, but they didn't get paid. So the most important reason was for education and for money wise too.
Did your family have a choice of where they could go before coming to the U.S.? Or I guess because we were listening to Rupal earlier about how refugees sort of put in certain places. Is that what happened to you?
Yes, they put me first. We arrived at Georgia, Atlanta. And after staying there for two days, my uncle's was from Indiana. He came to get us after 2 days, because he already have a lot of friends that he knows that can take care of us. But Georgia, Atlanta, we don't know anyone that can take care of us. So that's why the reason why we moved to a different state.
Yeah, that's got to be a lot of transitions going from Burma to Malaysia to Georgia to Indiana. So you saw a lot. And you were young. And so I wonder, you know, what was that like as a kid coming here and experiencing all that? Were you nervous at all?
I would say more than nervous. I was more excited, because I get to see a lot of things, and I get to experience a new thing, and I would get to have education. But I feel like if I were my parents, I don't think I would be able to do that. But I felt like I was really happy moving here.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's always a harder transition for older people, because they're used to their life and their patterns and habits and friends and stuff. And when you're younger, it's easier to adapt quickly to new changes.
Yeah, that's true, because I don't really get attached with anyone back in Malaysia or back in Burma, but I still do have family. But of course, it's a lot easier for me more than my parents.
Well, you have family still in Burma. Have you been able to go back and see them, or is it too dangerous?
I was about to go back in 2020 before COVID hit, and then I was thinking that maybe I can go back after COVID is over. But due to military coup, I don't think I'll be able to go back until everything is back to normal, because it's too dangerous right now.
Right. Well, we wish you the best, and hopefully, you know, things get better over there. How has the recent news about the refugees coming from Afghanistan made you feel being a refugee yourself?
I am very happy for them. If they can get more people, I think it would be very nice, because they will have education just like me, and then they will be able to stay with their family, especially when I see a lot of videos about their children being hand to a stranger for bad. That's very, as myself, I imagine myself being like that. I don't think I can do that. But if they are coming together as a family, I think it would be really nice for them.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely got to be scary to be separated and having to try to make a new life. What is it like for you now that you've been here for a while? I don't know exactly how long, but you've been here for a while. You've grown up here. Learning the culture and being part of the culture, was it a difficult transition for you?
Learning the culture was a bit difficult when I first got here, especially with the eye contact, because I know that American culture is a bit different than our culture. Our culture, we like to be polite to our older people because they are the one that taught us how to be respect to your older people. So they always told us that if you look someone in the eyes and if they talk to you, that's disrespectful. But here in America, that's not the case. If you don't look at them in the eyes, it's disrespectful. So yeah, it's I think I had a hard time about until I finished school. So it took me 7 years to figure that out.
Well, that is a big difference. And, you know, I think it's interesting because I think a lot of cultures outside of the United States, like even my own background, the Arab culture, there's a lot of sort of respect to older people and the way you address them and you talk to them. Even Rupal was talking earlier about like sir and madam. And then it seems like it's very casual here.
Yes, I used to have a hard time calling people by their names because it's very, very disrespectful to call by their names. Back in Burma, we even if they're not our mom and dad, we call them mom and dad.
Yeah, yeah. Or like auntie, uncle, stuff like that.
That's what we use. So it's like it's very different here.
Well, were there any things about American culture that surprised you? I mean, aside from some of these the respect and the etiquette, but I don't know, was there anything maybe that surprised you or that you really enjoyed? I don't know.
Yeah, I really enjoyed like everyone had that mindset of like treating someone, even if they're younger than you, you treat them the same age as you. I really like that because I don't think we were taught that way. So it's really that helped me. And I really love that part of American culture.
And what is it meant to have, you know, these large Burmese communities, I believe in Indianapolis and Fort Wayne? What has that been? How has that played a pivotal role, I guess, in your experience here?
Having a large of community here, I think it helped us strengthen the community as a whole. And it helped us with helping back Burma with what is happening right now. And having a community with a large group is always better to be than alone because it helped us with a lot of things. Let's say financial and with support and just basically everything.
Well, since you've experienced what it's like to come to the United States, a new place, a new culture, what would you say to listeners who are thinking they want to help and they don't know what to do? What is something that you wished people had known about when you came here?
So when I came here, I had a caseworker that helped us through everything. And then he was very nice. And I don't remember the name anymore. And then also when I came here, when we came here from Malaysia to Georgia, there was a lady that helped us with that helped us. She was very nice. She says to us this. She gave us $100 and then we told her that we are refugee from Burma. And she gave us $100 and told us that if you need anything, give me a call. And she gave us her number and everything. I can't forget about that person. And also our case manager, because he was very nice. He helped us set her everything. And before we moved, he even helped us. He even asked if he can help with the moving process. But he did. And then he refunded us the money, all of the money that we received. And a lot of people I don't think a lot of people are receiving the same treatment as we do. But if you are one of those who are looking to help out, I think financial support is very needed for them right now.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate you sharing your story with us today. Dolly Ta is the employment specialist for the Chin Community of Indiana. With us now to learn more about the work the Chin Community of Indiana does for Burmese We have Peter Tongmong, president of the Chin community of Indiana. Welcome to the program, Peter.
Hello. Thank you for having us. Thank you, NPR, and RuPaul with the Asian American Alliance. We appreciate the opportunity to be on the air with you.
Peter, what work does your organization do for the community?
Okay. So the Chin community of Indiana was initiated, started about 20 years ago, but from the small group that was that settled in Indianapolis. And so since then, the focus of the community organization has been to support the people that came from Burma with their human needs. So mostly social needs, employment needs. And even today, that's basically what we do is when people have any issues with the culture, language, employment, they come to our office. We have an office called Chin Center of Indianapolis, and that's where we provide all the help that, to all these people.
You mentioned social needs, and I think that's something that we often overlook. We think of other things, I guess, you know, in the immediate needs of refugees. How important is the social aspect?
Absolutely important. I think the two most important help that a refugee needs is one, employment. Employment is totally essential for that. And secondly, you know, healthcare and social. So those are way up there. The social needs can range from, you know, you got some counseling needs to integration into the new culture, understanding of what's going on around them. So it's very important. So I think that's still, you know, population daily, those are the kind of help that we're providing to them.
And how do you set up these services for refugees through your organization? How do people find out about what you offer?
Okay, so number one, within our community, there's roughly 25,000 Chin Burmese population living in Indianapolis area. So we're a fairly tight-knit community, so everybody knows our existence. Number two, we have office hours from 9 to 5, working with a staff of 5, providing, you know, welcoming, number one, and providing the services that people need. Sometimes there are services that we can't do ourselves, so we act as a referral to outside services that may be available.
And do you collaborate with other organizations around the state or in the city?
Absolutely. We've got other organizations, whether it's healthcare or social needs school. That's a big one, local school system, to meet the needs of our people.
And when you see what's happening now with Afghan refugees coming into Indiana, is the Chin community coming together to help them transition to life in Indiana?
So, for one, when we see cases like in Afghanistan, number one, we're very sympathetic. You know, we think it's so terrible that what they have to go through. A lot of our people went through similar situation where the military government of Burma basically, you know, right now they took the power over, but over years of discrimination, child labor and so on and so forth and fighting. So we went through similar experiences as them. So we have a lot of sympathy for them. I think it's wonderful that some of them have opportunity to come to America or other countries as refugees. And I think this is a case where we believe that people should be given opportunities. And when they come to the U.S., through a legal mean, which may mean refugee status. You have to be a refugee status to be able to come to the U.S. And you work here and you contribute. I think that's what we like to see, and that's what we promote. We would love to be able to help people from Afghanistan through our Chin Community Center. We have a lot of networks and, you know, things that we do, and we would be happy to support them.
Well, we have about a minute left. I'll ask you what I asked Dolly. What do you think our listeners can do to help out, whether it's your organization or other organizations?
So number one, welcoming them is very important. I think this country is, you know, started by immigrants, and we have to remember whoever come here legally should be welcomed and provide them opportunities. Number two, most of these refugees will produce. As you can see with our own community, we're producing, we provide a great labor force. Afghanistan's will, I'm sure, will provide a similar type of contribution to the U.S. So let's welcome them. Let's provide what they need and then make this country a great country with all these people working hard to contribute to the country.
Peter Tong Meng is the president of the Chin Community of Indiana. Coming up next, we'll learn about a streaming service launched earlier this summer that was exclusively built to present Indiana documentaries. If you want to get in touch with us, you can reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. A reminder, this show is taped, but you can still reach out to us. I'm Miriam Sobel. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. It's the Friday recap where we look back at some of our favorite conversations we had this week. Up next, we'll learn about a streaming service launched earlier this summer that was exclusively built to present Indiana documentaries. With us are Rocky Walls, executive director of Hudocs, and Rachel Hardy, a filmmaker whose movie Black Unscripted is on the streaming service. Can you tell us about Black Unscripted and where did the idea come from?
Yeah, so Black Unscripted is a short documentary that deals with this idea of Blackness and what it means to be Black. So oftentimes there are stereotypes that are put on Black people, both from within our own community and outside of our community, that kind of says like, so you should listen to like this type of music or watch these type of shows or have these specific interests in order to really be considered Black. And anything that deviates from those kind of stereotypical views kind of takes away some form of your Blackness, which is really weird. So it kind of, it deals with that. It is features five different people who have very different backgrounds and perspectives. And so within those five people, we also touch on subtopics such as albinism. There is a guy in it who is albino. We also talk about like vitiligo awareness because one of the ladies who's in the documentary has vitiligo. And then we also talk about colorism and immigration. There's a guy who was born and raised in Zimbabwe and then moved to the U.S. Living in Indiana. And so he talks about kind of the difference in those racial views coming from a place where you're a majority to now being in the U.S. where Blacks are considered the minority. And the idea from it really came because at the time I was working in video production still, but I had a part-time job and it really just felt like I was struggling to be creative within the job that I held. So it was a way for me to kind of just really challenge my own creativity and see what I could do. And there have been oftentimes like throughout my childhood growing up where people would make comments, that kind of made you think about whether or not you liked certain things or try to make you kind of conform to what they believed Black people should act like. And that actually happened when I was on a freelance gig. I happened to be the only Black person in maybe a group of like 10 people. And they were talking about music and concerts at the time. And I remember one person brought up a rapper that she liked and she mentioned the rapper to the group and nobody else in the group knew who the rapper was. And then she turned to me and made a comment along the lines of, oh, well, I know you know who he is and I know that you like him. And I was like, actually, no, I really don't listen to his music. And the look on her face was like extreme shock. Like she didn't understand why I would have never heard of that rapper or why I wouldn't enjoy going to that specific concert. And so that was when it hit me, when I realized this has been happening for a while. And so just kind of taking that experience and really wanting to look more into why is this kind of the common thing that has happened over the years, where I keep feeling like I'm in these positions where people assume what I should like or assume kind of my interest. And then when I tell them that it's something different from that, there's this shock. And so that kind of, I guess, at that moment was the launching pad for me really wanting to look into this topic and explore it more.
I love that you shared all of that. Thank you so much. And I feel like it's so relatable to so many people when they feel like they're boxed into something, and the fact that you were able to take that and create something out of it is really impressive. Rocky, films like this on WhoDocs, how has that been for the streaming service?
Amazing. I was fortunate enough to have a conversation with Rachel around about the time she was trying to figure out where she wanted to distribute this film. And I think, if I'm not, Rachel can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's available exclusively on WhoDocs right now, which is really fantastic. It is exactly the type of thing that we've been talking about, where, you know, around about this time last year, even a little earlier this time last year, anti-racist books started becoming, you know, bestsellers. And the idea of understanding people of color and understanding ways to dismantle systemic racism, or even just checking your biases, like, you know, what Rachel just described, the experience that people can have when someone thinks that they know what you like or who you are, when in fact they really don't. This kind of thing became very mainstream and very, very popular all of a sudden. And I think it's great to be able to pick up an anti-racist book from Barnes & Noble or order it off of Amazon and understand those kinds of concepts from a 20,000 foot view. But I think what's really special about what Rachel has done and what other films like hers on WhoDocs can accomplish is this gives you a perspective that's hyper-local. These are folks who live around you and possibly represent somebody in your own neighborhood. This is from a filmmaker who at the time was living in Indiana. And I think that local aspect and understanding not just an idea or an issue or a way that we can make our world a better place, make our communities better places, from a really high level, this brings it down to something much more local and much more specific, which I think is really valuable.
Well, Rachel, when you put this together, what made you go down the documentary route versus like a fictional film, a movie or a series?
You know, I personally have just had a very strong interest in documentaries. And I feel like that's really where my strengths in storytelling lie, is more of the telling of real stories through real people, as opposed to like writing a script and getting actors and all of that. And then I also just think there's something really special about being able to hear these personal stories from these people in their own words. So that was really why I chose to go the documentary route.
Rocky, we talked a little bit earlier about the range of topics covered in the documentaries that are hosted on WhoDocs. Has anything surprised you about what people are making films about?
I think I'm pleasantly surprised every time I see the description and some of the images from a film, because in a way it's like taking a drink of cold water on a hot day. You know, we are. Like we talked about, just bombarded with media, with news, with commercial advertising. And I think that by and large, a lot of it is really draining and stressful, for me at least. And I think that when I see something that a filmmaker has taken the time to put together, it reminds me of how there is such a great opportunity, and not to sound too fluffy, but like there's good in the world. Like we can see Rachel's work and see these individuals that she spent time kind of tracking down and then sitting down with and having a conversation. We can understand a little bit more about bats in Indiana and what that means for our forests. So we can understand a little bit more about Gary and learn a little bit about an individual who made amazing differences in a lot of young people's lives. And I think that all of those things, because they're real, because they're true, are like a breath of fresh air. And so it is surprising. It shouldn't be, because we shouldn't really be surprised that there are all these great stories out there. But I think right now I am a little surprised every single time I see it. And I think that can be, you know, good and bad. I hope it get to a point where I'm not really surprised anymore. I'm just really thankful that we have all this great stuff that's being done here in Indiana.
Rachel, you're from Indiana, and the people in Black Unscripted lived here at the time, but you've moved to Atlanta since then. That's my understanding. What got you to leave Indiana?
Actually, it was a very hard decision for me, because I was born and raised in Indiana, grew up there, and I honestly really love Indiana. I love the feel of the town, of being in Indianapolis. I'm really close to my family. But it was always just difficult for me to find full-time, consistent video work. A lot of the things that I was doing was always freelance. So they'd be contract things here or there, or landing part-time jobs. And so it just felt like I had to move career-wise. And so that was honestly something that I struggled with for a while, because I felt like I was being pulled to go out of state to where there were bigger video markets. Because Atlanta, there's a lot more video work, and like finding that work is a lot easier. But I did really struggle with wanting to be home. So ultimately, career decision to move and be able to land a full-time job.
Rocky, when you hear that, I mean, how do you keep talent in Indiana if it sounds like there aren't opportunities?
Well, I think that that's part of our goal with WhoDocs too. I think that we want to elevate the conversation and elevate the culture around filmmaking in Indiana, because I think that there are a lot of opportunities, but Rachel's right. They are harder to find. And if you want to work on a really huge movie set, or if you want to work on a big TV series, there are definitely very limited opportunities. I think specifically in the field of documentary, there might be a little more to choose from. And so I think that what has to happen is Indiana has to recognize that filmmaking and storytelling in general, and then just expanding that to just creative arts, in the creative field in general, as broadly as you want to draw that circle. It's important for Indiana to continue focusing on how to appreciate those that we have and try and keep them here, and how to attract people to come here to Indiana. And that's a conversation for another whole day. But I do think that's important. And I think that's what WhoDocs wants to try and contribute to.
Well, are there any efforts underway to make things more attractive for filmmakers in Indiana?
There are things. I think that you'd have to have somebody on that understands tax incentives and things like that way better than I do to talk about that. But you can look up the storied history that Indiana has with tax incentives. I also think that there's a lot to be said for recognizing the work that's here and amplifying that work. And so whether it's WhoDocs or any of the other Indiana organizations that can elevate, you know, industry partners of ours at WhoDocs are our Heartland Film Festival and the Indie Film Fest. And as we grow to try and embrace a whole statewide community and ecosystem here, there are other film festivals and folks who do focus on shining a spotlight on Indiana created content. But we need Hoosiers to kind of wake up and recognize the amazing storytelling that is happening here, and to kind of say, just like you would for your local restaurant or your local boutique gift shop, to step up and say, we love you, Indiana filmmakers, and we want more of you. We want you to stay here. We want you to make films about our great state and the people and places in it, and make that voice heard.
Well, when it comes to the stuff that you have on WhoDocs, are you presenting any of those at film festivals? Does WhoDocs have a film festival?
No, WhoDocs is kind of picked its place to live in the ecosystem of film in Indiana very carefully, and we definitely don't want to you know, reinvent the wheel. And so we've got some really incredible film festivals that we partner with. And so you'll see films that are on HuDocs. They will have already been at film festivals oftentimes, or potentially at times they will be on HuDocs and maybe featured at film festivals. Actually, we have representatives from both the biggest film festivals in Indianapolis on our board, who are very great at helping us to understand what's going on with both Heartland and Indie Film Fest. And I think that HuDocs kind of exists in its own corner of this ecosystem, where we want to focus on the online distribution of documentary films. And so creating events or creating festivals is not on our docket, but rather we want to amplify what others are already doing in that arena.
Rachel, documentaries are definitely a lot of work. There's a lot that goes on behind the scenes that people don't see before you put out the final project. What was it like having your film be released on HuDocs and for people to be able to see it?
Honestly, I think HuDocs really has been a blessing. I think it was mentioned before, but I was in the moment where I had been through film festivals. So I went through the whole film festival circuit. And then once that was done, I really didn't know where my film should land at that point. I felt like it wasn't over, that there was more to be done with it, but I just didn't know where to go outside of festivals since that run had been over. And luckily, Rocky reached out to me and I met him and he told me about HuDocs and it just felt like the perfect fit. And then also just like the community of being able to be featured on there with other Indiana filmmakers, because before HuDocs, I would have never known where to go to find work from other Indiana filmmakers or even find out what's out there. So it feels like it's kind of built this connection and kind of this community. And that's something that for me has been really special to be a part of.
Well, speaking of connection, Rocky, are you hopeful HuDocs will help connect filmmakers to each other and lead to more creative teams making films more than what we have right now?
Yeah, definitely. You know, we've seen it a little bit already, anecdotally. I mean, I don't have big numbers to pull out for that particular question, but I know that there have been two or three times just I personally have been reached out to by other filmmakers who said, hey, I'm so glad we met because I have this project I'm working on and I really need a director of photography next weekend. And I was able to connect people to be able to work together. And I think that that's one thing that I heard over and over again from filmmakers also as we led up to the launch of HuDocs, that the filmmaking community is also sort of siloed and there are a lot of folks who work together pretty often and they really don't know anybody else in the industry. And I think that comes from having a less than active filmmaking industry, like Rachel had talked about. You know, we're not Atlanta, we're not LA, we're not Chicago or New York. And so I think that because folks are sort of working in an area of the state where they're sort of able to do enough work to keep themselves busy and maybe pay their bills, they're not necessarily getting out and connecting at a citywide or statewide level. And I do hope that HuDocs continues to be that community, maybe not exclusively, but at least a big part of that community building momentum that we can find.
Rocky Walls is executive director of HuDocs, and Rachel Hardy is a filmmaker whose movie Black Unscripted is on the streaming service. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.